From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The Democratic Republic of Congo, as large as the United States east of the Mississippi, rich in diamonds, gold, water, rainforest, land, precious minerals, and mired in conflict that can seem unending, mindless. But there are real interests tied to war in Congo. Some of them loop back to this country. In the last week, it's flared again in Congo's big eastern city of Goma. The human cost over decades is gruesomely high and often hidden. This hour, On Point Congo and the war at the heart of Africa. You can join the conversation. Do you know this conflict? It's estimated 5 million dead. What keeps this going? Could we stop it? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. John Burnett of NPR joins us in a moment. On Friday, he delivered this report from a town, the town of Sake, just outside of Goma in eastern Congo, on the border, near the border with Rwanda. He spoke with several Sake residents there who were fleeing the invasion of a rebel group called M23 in their town.
All we know is that we have to leave. We don't know where we're going or where we'll sleep, says a distraught man whose small son struggles with a bicycle laden with two bulky bedrolls and three ducks hanging from the handlebars. You're the most powerful nation in the world, he says, addressing a radio reporter. Why don't you save us?
Why don't you save us? From eastern Congo there, joining us now from Nairobi, Kenya, is NPR correspondent John Burnett, just back from reporting in Congo's big eastern city, Goma, overtaken last week by rebel forces, M23. John Burnett, welcome back to On Point. What's the latest out of Goma? We've heard reports that M23, the rebels, may have, be leaving or have left.
Hey, Tom, it's nice to be with you on your show. It's so confusing. It's just gone back and forth. Every news cycle, we hear a different version of events from M23. The latest one is that this self-styled rebel group in Congo is not going to pull out of Goma unless their conditions are met by President Joseph Kabila over in Kinshasa, in the capital, way on the west side of the nation. This is in direct conflict from what we heard earlier, that they were prepared to leave by Friday and that they would pull out of Goma, this very important border city of 500,000 people on Lake Kivu. They would do so without conditions. What we're also getting is the undiscipline and the lack of consistent leadership within M23, that you really got several talking heads saying different things.
You know, John, I know Goma a bit there on Lake Kivu, the border city, as you say. I've seen its slums, the huge refugee camps outside. At least when I was there, the resplendent mansions on the shores of Lake Kivu there. But can you give our listeners a sense, in Congo, eastern Congo maybe in particular, of just how ungoverned this country is?
Yeah, and that's a really good question, because I think it helps to understand both the environment that M23 is invading and the response of the people who feel utterly abandoned. This is an enormous country. The DRC, which formerly Zaire, is as big as Western Europe. And it's just, it's a completely dysfunctional country. The eastern section, which is where all the trouble has come in and has been plundered and invaded by repeated armies over the past 10, 15 years, is almost like a separate country. It's not even connected by a highway to the western part of the country, to the capital of Kinshasa. You have to fly there. And so roads are in very poor condition. Schools are bad. Electricity is spotty. The army is not paid, which is one reason why they steal from the people. Teachers are not paid. It's really extremely underdeveloped. And so in this milieu, you have this rebel group that comes about, and they say, we're going to be your government now, and we're going to make things better for you, which is kind of a sketchy promise coming from them. The people in the northern and southern Kivu provinces really do feel abandoned by Kabila's government, and they don't really care who governs them, just as long as they can start having some of the basic infrastructure of a life.
And give us a sense of how this conflict plays out. We're going to look at interests at play in this hour, but just how it plays out, because we're seeing here that over the last couple of decades, there are estimates of 5 million deaths in this rolling conflict, reports of mass rapes, maybe 1,000 a day. What does this conflict look like on the ground to produce that level of death and carnage and suffering? John, how's it play out?
Well, it's really, really complicated for one thing, and so you have to kind of pull this out. In the first place, that figure of 5 million dead is contested. There are some who say it's more like 1 million dead. That's still a lot. It's still a vast number of people, and it's not necessarily through hostilities. What's really tragic about this is that the number of people who died, whether it's 1 million or 5 million, mainly in the in what was called for the Congolese World War, which is when all these nations got involved in it. That was from 1998 to 2003. And most folks died because they were displaced, because of the conditions of displacement we're seeing right now repeated in and around Goma. So they died of malnutrition. They died of exposure. They died of preventable diseases like malaria, diarrheal diseases, pneumonia, respiratory diseases. And so so this is what happens, is these marauding militias, which have these kind of flaky ideologies, they start going through these villages and enjoying the plunders of being men with guns, which would be raping women and stealing livestock. There are minerals nearby, commandeering benefits of that. M23 is a little bit different, though. They're not really they're a bit, if I may say so, a bit more sophisticated than some of these other militias, which have just been in it for sort of the women and the money and the spoils.
Well, partly we're reading here because M23 may be related to Rwanda. That can be a good thing or a bad thing. I mean, but remind us of the proximity of Rwanda, the very complex history here, but immediate, direct history. I mean, Rwanda, the tiny state next door, suffered genocide in the mid-90s, has pursued those who perpetrated that into Congo afterward, took out Mobutu Sese Seko, essentially, put in their own guy, Laurent Kabila. When he didn't sort of follow their lead, the report is had him murdered, replaced him with his son, Joseph Kabila, who's there now, who the rebels say they want out. How big is the Rwanda? And it's not the only footprint, but it's right next door, and it's pretty potent, and it's a darling of many in Washington. How big is the Rwandan footprint in Congo?
Rwanda's fingerprints are all over this conflict, and for them to continue denying it kind of stretches belief, because the group of experts has done an exhaustive report in which they found that Rwanda, was involved in every aspect of M23's creation, both in the recruiting of soldiers and the military support. And we need to go back 4 years, Tom, because M23 is nothing more than a retread, an earlier group of rebels called the National Congress for the Defense of the People. Rwanda was openly supporting them. And interestingly, the same group of rebels, mainly Tutsi, which is now the minority that rules Rwanda, they came to the edge of Goma and they called Kabila's hand and they said, we want these conditions. And so what happened is, so the president of Congo agreed to the conditions, and he lets this rebel band, which is an earlier name, into his army. And so they stay there for a few years. They get a bunch of grievances and are unhappy for a different reason. So in April of this year, the same guerrilla group that is now part of the Congolese army mutinies. They desert, and they become M23. But Rwanda, most of the analysts say, is still their patron. Why? Some people think it's because of the mineral wealth, which you mentioned in your intro, that is in the Kivus that Rwanda gets hands on. Others say it's because Rwanda wants to create a buffer state to protect itself from these Hutu guerrillas who fled into Congo after the genocide. And of course, Rwanda denies everything strenuously and says they're just being ganged up by the international community.
Does Rwanda feel it can act with impunity here? Because it has, as you know, been kind of a darling of a lot of Western aid donors, not least from the United States,
I don't think so. And the reason why is because there's been a lot of really fierce criticism of Rwanda backing M23 this time around. The UK has already cut off all of its foreign aid to Rwanda. The U.S. State Department has done taken a similar action, and a lot of Rwanda's neighbors are upset as well. So, the atmosphere seems to have changed a bit from 4 years ago.
We just got half a minute, John, but where could peace and prosperity lie here? I mean, their own central government in Kinshasa seems an utter failure. Where's the light in this story, John?
Oh, brother. That's a really tough one. I mean, I spent some time with some humanitarian groups like Oxfam. I found they were doing really terrific work with, trying to ease the suffering of some of the people. The light is that this needs to be a competent government in Kinshasa. The problem here may not be so much what M23 is doing, but that Kinshasa cannot govern its country.
And that at the heart of the great, huge country of Congo, at the heart of Africa. John Burnett with NPR, just out of Goma, East Congo, today in Nairobi, Kenya. Thank you very much for being with us, John.
It's been a pleasure, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Africa's endless war in Congo, the conflict at the very heart of the continent. Here, M23 rebels spoke to the public of Goma in eastern Congo by loudspeaker a day after taking over the town last week.
On behalf of the M23, on behalf of the population of North Kivu, and on behalf of the population of the Democratic Republic of Congo, God bless you. God bless you.
God bless you. The latest rebels to come through, dead bodies all over the place. We read in the reporting from there, Al Jazeera spoke yesterday with the residents of Goma about the role of UN troops in the conflict.
I know the UN's mandate is to protect civilians, but it should also protect the country.
I was returning home and there were two groups of soldiers. I don't know who bombed my home. I'm asking now, what should I do?
I thank the UN because there was no bloodshed when the M23 came into the city, but that's the only thing I can say the UN has done to bring security.
Voices out of Congo just in the last few days were trying to understand this seemingly endless conflict at the heart of a country so big as Western Europe, in the heart of Africa. With us right now from Washington is Jennifer Cook, director of the Africa Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Jennifer, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks, Tom.
And with us from Goma in eastern Congo is Jason Stearns, author of Dancing in the Glory of Monsters. He joins us from the scene today. Jason, thanks very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
That's a long satellite round trip to get you, but tell us what you see. Are the rebels still in Goma? Are there signs of them leaving? Have they gone again?
The rebels are moving out of Goma. The latest we heard is that they're on their way out. They send truck after truck of weapons and ammunition ahead of them. I just met with one of their commanders now here in Goma and told me that tomorrow morning, the other fellow commanders will follow them just to the north of Goma.
Can you see, it was a largely peaceful takeover, I guess, but we read reports of dead Congolese soldiers all over in the countryside around Goma, of the prison. Oh, I think we've lost Jason in Goma. Sorry for that. Jennifer, I don't know what you're getting in terms of firsthand reports. We've lost our satellite link to Jason in Goma for the moment. But what about the damage that came along with this takeover, or was it largely peaceful?
Well, I think the real damage, and as John said at the outset of this kind of takeover, mm-hmm. is the displacement that it causes and the fear among populations that have been terrorized really for decades now. And you do have people fleeing. We heard at the outset some of those voices of people who are traveling with bikes with bedrolls on the back and in fear for their lives. And this is one of just many cycles of violence that has kind of swept that area. And I understand that the Congolese forces essentially fled Goma, looting as they went and raping as they went, and no doubt many were killed as they ran away. Hard to get a good picture of exactly what's going on from here, since things are changing day by day and different reports coming out from N23 itself.
I think we've got Jason Stearns back in Goma. Jason, can you describe what the displacement of people has been, what violence there's been associated with this, what the impact has been in this surge of rebels into Goma?
Well, you know, the biggest killer in the Congo has always been displacement. The Congolese war, you mentioned the figure of 5 million dead. 90-95% of those are people who died to easily treatable diseases and hunger once they were displaced. So the big killer here really is displacement, not face-to-face combat. And we've had a lot of displacement recently. We've had, since the beginning of this year, the humanitarian organizations here count 700,000 people displaced just around Goma. And that, of course, is going to have a crushing impact on people, on their livelihoods. And, of course, mortality is going to go up. People are dying.
Displacement sounds kind of tame, but of course it's not. When you get away from your life support system in this part of the world, you can die quickly, easily. And of course, we've had reports of mass rape along with this. What about, are there still refugee camps on the outskirts of Goma? Last I was there, Jason, they were very large ones. Are they still there? What's happened with that from former Rwandan refugees in large part?
No, there are no refugee camps. Those refugee camps were broken up in 1996, mm-hmm. but those camps have more or less been replaced by IDP camps. There was a very large IDP camp just to the north of Goma that was broken up when the M23 advanced on Goma. Those people then went running. They'd already been displaced from their homes. They'd run many, many miles to get to the IDP camp. They had a very, very slim lifeline. They had just a little bit of food and nourishment for them and their children. And then they were displaced once again and had to run, in some cases, 20, 30, 40 miles with all their belongings on their heads. This is really what hurts the most for people, and this is what kills.
Still big camps, refugee camps in a way, but internally displaced persons outside Goma there. Jason, our line with you is good at the moment, and I don't know how long that will last. So let me go right to this question. You've got Rwanda right next door. There's a very intermeshed history here. Rwanda, of course, had its genocide. Hutus slaughtered Tutsis. Then Tutsis took over Rwanda. The Hutus, many fled into Congo right next door. The Tutsis, Rwanda, followed them in there, fought with them. They've gone all the way to Kinshasa at different times, put their own guy in there, put another guy in there. Is Rwanda keeping Congo in a state of conflict? Is this Rwanda's doing? And is it for reasons that are justifiable or are inhumane, Jason?
We can't blame Rwanda for everything that's going on in the Congo. The Congo had been a mess far before Rwanda got involved in it. It suffers many endemic problems that have nothing to do with Rwanda, and including an extremely weak, fragmented, corrupt government and extremely weak institutions. And I think the collapse of the Congolese army and its indiscipline over the last couple of weeks has just been a sign and a symbol of that. Nonetheless, the Rwandan government has been involved, very heavily involved in backing this rebellion from the very beginning. I would go so far as saying that this rebellion would not exist currently if the Rwandan government had not backed it, because it was on the brink of collapse. And the Rwandan government is really at the center of this crisis as well. So I think it's a nuanced picture we have to paint.
And what about Susan Rice's role in painting that picture? I mean, last summer, We read that Washington was loosening its ties with the Rwandan president, Paul Kagame, long a favorite of the donor community, because of this, the allegations, more than allegations, that his government was stirring violence in the Congo. Susan Rice has remained pretty warm toward Rwanda, the UN ambassador. Why is that, Jason?
Susan Rice has been a close friend of Rwanda since the mid-1990s. She served, of course, in the Clinton administration between 1993 and 2001, And all of the positions she held there were focused on Africa. She was National Security Council, and then she was Assistant Secretary of State for Africa. And during that time, I think the first thing that happened on her watch, she was still a relatively junior official, but nonetheless, she was in the National Security Council, was the genocide. And as she herself has said, she was personally very struck and affected by the genocide and felt that her inaction, her personal inaction, as well as the inaction of the U.S. government, was inexcusable. And she vowed never to, to be passive again in the face of such mass atrocities. And I think that also shaped not only her relations, but also the relations of other people in the Clinton administration towards the government of Paul Kagame that in many ways seemed like and is a visionary government that has achieved amazing things in Rwanda in terms of reforms, in terms of social services, healthcare, rebuilding the country after the genocide. But at the same time, the policy of the U.S. government towards Rwanda lacked nuance. The Rwandan government not only was doing wonderful things at home, it was also restraining domestic opposition, limiting the public space, and in particular waging an extremely brutal war in neighboring Congo, a war that it justified based on the fact that its enemies were in eastern Congo, its enemies that included some of the people who perpetrated the 1994 genocide. But in the name of that war against its enemies, it committed enormous atrocities. Tens of thousands of people were killed by Rwandan forces of the Allies in the eastern Congo, and the U.S. looked the other way. So their policy towards Rwanda has long lacked nuance. And I think that this most recent episode where Susan Rice has stepped in on numerous occasions over the last 7 months during this new rebellion as the ambassador to the U.N. to give the Rwandan government the benefit of the doubt in this is another sign of, you could say, the cozy relationships that she has with the government in Kigali and her belief that it is not through criticism but through constructive engagement with the Rwandan government that we need to solve this crisis.
Kigali, of course, the capital of Rwanda, and all this right next door, right tucked into the belly of Congo there. Jennifer, I don't know where you come down on this, but let me just, I'm reading here in The Guardian, and sometimes they're more unvarnished in the way they put things. And they say Rwanda's success, and it has become, after the genocide and now under Tutsi rule, it's become this kind of tidy little darling of many, or has been internationally. But The Guardian writes, Rwanda's success is Congo's loss. Rwanda and Ugandan, right next door, regimes have armed militias there, including M23. The militias protect the Tutsis, the now dominant Congo group, Paul Kagame's group. They guard them in eastern Congo. They guard mines and plantations controlled by senior Rwandan and Ugandan officers. They control and tax trade routes that bring loot across the border to Uganda and Rwanda. Above all, they ensure that no order, security, or justice takes hold in eastern Congo. The Guardian says each village has a militia, and many have turned into roving gangs, killing, raping, stealing at will. Controlled anarchy in eastern Congo suits Rwanda and Uganda as long as it doesn't get out of hand. What about those powerful charges, Jennifer?
Yeah, I mean, as Jason said, there are some legitimate security concerns that Rwanda has in eastern Congo, but they're enmeshed with political interests, economic interests, access to those minerals that Kinshasa, the capital of DRC, has very little control over, and you know, Rwanda's economy is tiny in and of its own, and it's great. Hope for economic expansion and growth lies in eastern Congo.
So has it become a new imperial power, a new colonist over neighboring Congo?
I think that's, in some ways, its ambition. Now, I mean, I think, you know, speaking of the light at the end of the tunnel, in the long run, there is a possibility of a constructive economic framework for the region that empowers Rwanda and gives them access to the Congolese market and so forth, and that also benefits Congolese in terms of taxing and a regulatory structure and so forth. That's a long ways away. But meanwhile, with the vacuum there, the security concerns that Rwanda has and the economic spoils to be had, it's moving in a very significant way and in kind of a creating this sphere of influence there over which it is the most able to control.
Jason, you're in Goma. You're right there in eastern Congo. Cut right to the chase because we don't have forever. A lot of Americans are listening. Our government is involved in this. We see this suffering. We don't want to take it lightly. So, I mean, is this a situation where you're sympathetic to Rwanda because here's this big potential chaos on its border? Or has it turned into Rwandan and Ugandan generals sort of lining their pockets, having militias running all over the place, Rwanda itself becoming a kind of new colonialist in the heart of Africa and needs to have, you know, needs to be reined in?
I think it's a little bit more nuanced than that sort of dichotomy that you painted there. But the Rwandan government, there's no doubt that they're involved here. They've backed armed groups, not just for self-defense, but also to promote their interests, their economic, financial interests, and in general to keep a sphere of influence here in the Eastern Congo. They want the part of this Eastern Congo to be in their sphere of influence. They feel that they need to keep a foot in the Eastern Congo, and this M23 rebel group and predecessor groups have been that foothold here in the Eastern Congo. I think that where I think U.S. policy needs to be, the United States has been a very strong partner of Rwanda in the past, not only through its own aid, but also collaborating with the Rwandan government and peacekeeping, and through multilateral institutions, World Bank, International Monetary Fund, and spending billions of dollars in past years and backing up the Rwandan government. And in many ways, that's justified given the successes that Rwanda has been able to push forward domestically in healthcare and education, things I mentioned. But there has been this separation in our policy mind, this sort of schizophrenia, where we invest a lot of money and back up the Rwandan government at home, but we look the other way in terms of Rwanda's actions in the Eastern Congo. So we can no longer, I think, separate those two issues. And I think we need a more honest engagement with the Rwandan government if we are going to be there and back them in their endeavors to become a better, stronger, more prosperous country. That's only going to work if they also limit their engagements here in Eastern Congo, or at least play a more constructive engagement and promote legal trade and the stability in Eastern Congo instead of destabilizing Eastern Congo.
We're trying to look straight at this and look at it with all the honesty we can muster right here. Katie in New Orleans. Lots of callers waiting to get in here. Katie, New Orleans, thanks. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I was in Goma in 2008, and I noticed what seemed to be a presence of U.S. peacekeeping troops. And so I'm just curious about the function or the role of those troops and what they're doing to help.
Yeah, UN, United Nations peacekeeping troops, they seem to have just kind of watched as all this unfolded recently. Jason, what about the UN troops there? Do they have any impact? I mean, they're from all over Africa, but do they calm anything down? Do they do anything?
They have been pummeled from all sides for their inaction on this. To a certain extent, and yes, I mean, I used to work for the UN peacekeeping troops, and there is a lot to find fault with UN peacekeeping, absolutely. On the other hand, their primary mandate was to back up the Congolese government. Once the Congolese army crumbled, it left, so to say, the UN holding the bag, and the UN was unable to defend Goma single-handedly once the Congolese government had crumbled. We're talking about the M23 is a non-conventional guerrilla force, uses non-conventional tactics, and UN peacekeepers, quite frankly, the countries that send troops to UN peacekeeping missions, here we're talking predominantly about India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, Uruguay, do not send their troops here to fight bloody counterinsurgencies. They send their troops here for much less riskier tasks. So I think it was not surprising that they would stand back once the Congolese army had crumbled and let the M23 into Goma without a fight.
You know, we're going to hear from a congressman in just a couple of minutes here who says the U.S. ought to be more involved here. But Jennifer, why do you think there hasn't been more effective international involvement? We've been involved, the global community, in conflicts with far lower levels of damage and displacement.
Well, part of it, I think, is just how complex and intractable this has been over the years. And it's, you know, the U.S. has been willing to deal, and the international community, with some of the symptoms of this. You know, even the peacekeeping mission, in a way, is, you know, what is the peace that they're trying to keep there? The conflict minerals bills, trying to trace minerals and origin, dealing with the issue of rape and so forth. But there hasn't been that comprehensive strategy that really tackles the core issue, which is governance in Kinshasa and regional intervention. We're ambivalent about Rwanda, and we just haven't had the stomach to push President Kabila to take this more seriously and build institutions that deliver security and services.
I'm I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about Africa's endless war in Congo, the conflict at the heart of that giant continent, in a country as big as Western Europe, as big as the United States, east of the Mississippi. Jennifer Cook is with us from the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington. From Goma, the city that's just seen rebel activity in eastern Congo, Jason Stearns joins us. He watches very closely blogs at Congo Siasa blog, author of Dancing in the Glory of Monsters, The Collapse of the Congo and the Great War of Africa. Jason, Jennifer, Bill says, everyone who has a cell phone is partially culpable. This includes me, he writes. It's called coltan, and Congo is where it comes from. It's in cell phones all over the world. AC writes, this war is about who gets to control the mining profits. No one is innocent here. And Judy writes, as long as it's in Africa, Americans don't care. Doesn't involve oil or Israel, so we'll never believe we have a stake in this fight. It's tragic. Jennifer, does the United States have a large stake in this fight?
Well, that's hard to say. I mean, it's basically, I think the humanitarian costs and are the greatest in terms of U.S. interest. The destabilizing impact, you know, when it draws in regional countries like Rwanda, like Uganda, as it did in earlier years, Angola, Zimbabwe, and so forth, it becomes this massive vacuum that has the potential to destabilize much beyond its borders. I think right now this is largely seen as a humanitarian crisis, and that's why I think some of the advocacy groups here have focused on the rape issue, on the displacement, the numbers of death. But the U.S. policy establishment, I think, hasn't really grasped this as a strategic interest, and hence the focus on kind of the symptoms of this rather than the big root causes. I think it's also difficult to grasp because there's no clear good guys versus bad guys, and it's been hard to kind of divide it into black and white. As Jason was saying, the complexity of this makes it very difficult to wrap your head around, you know, who's who, and where the solutions might lie. And that makes it very difficult for it's also very isolated from media exposure, and that makes it very difficult for U.S. to get galvanized on this.
We're going to hear in just a moment from Congressman Adam Smith from Washington State, who says the U.S. should be more involved here. Here's a question from Ellen, Jason. She says, if there's not even a highway linking Kinshasa in the west to the eastern Congo across that huge expanse, she says, what about internet or cell phones? Are the people connected in any meaningful way? And if not, maybe Congo should be split into governable segments or build them a road. I mean, is it too big to govern this enormous expanse of Africa, Jason? Is there another approach that people consider?
Well, it's a very good question. That's certainly something that's coming up increasingly. There are, at least within M23, the topic of secession is a very lively debate, or is something that certainly you hear a lot from M23 soldiers. However, I would say that this idea of cutting the country into smaller pieces usually comes from outsiders and not from Congolese themselves. In particular, in the eastern country, east of the country, secession is seen by many as a euphemism for control by outside forces. In particular, I think here in this eastern region where I am at the moment, secession of the eastern Congo, many people here would fear that they would be controlled by the stronger, better organized neighboring Rwanda, Uganda, and other countries. And I think so that's a lot of skepticism here with regards to secession. What is certainly true is that this country lacks viable infrastructure. But one thing that's striking, and one thing that dictator Mobutu Sese Seko, over the 32 years that he was in power, was able to do, was to craft a very strong sense of national identity. People here are connected through radio, through cell phones, through internet, but I think most particularly they're connected through a common culture. They all believe that they're Congolese.
Well, that's powerful in itself, but not powerful enough to hold this thing together. Well, Chris, in Somerville, Massachusetts, you're on the air, Chris. Thanks for calling.
Oh, thank you, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
My question is about the security of some of their more sensitive materials in the region, such as mines at Chinkolobwe, which, to put into context, is one of the most highly enriched naturally occurring deposits of uranium in the world. It's actually where most of our two nuclear bombs from World War II came from.
Well, let's look at that. Jennifer, what about control over it? We hear about all these amazing, often exotic, and rare minerals that come out of Congo. Who controls that? Speaking of interest, I mean, are there international conglomerates who have their tentacles in here? Does it all come out through, I don't know, sort of warlords in different parts of the country? What are the lines of interest around mineral wealth?
Well, I mean, that's where a lot of the competition comes, whether it's controlled by militia groups, whether it's controlled by elements of the Congolese army. There are major international interests in this as well. China, for example, has a major role in DRC mining. The U.S., the Congress introduced the conflict minerals provisions, which require kind of better tracking of the sources of these minerals
to our cell phones,
etc., to ensure that they're not fueling the conflict, that they're coming from legitimate mines owned and governed in a legitimate way. But that's proven extremely difficult, I think, because of the mix of players who control the mines, and there's huge competition over that.
It's hard to picture those supply lines, but we can imagine many of them funneling out. Sean in Raceland, Louisiana. Sean, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I was just my opinion. I think the United States does have a bigger role in Africa, because if they don't have any interest in it, what was the point of the United States sending a party out to look for some warlord down in Africa a few months ago? So I think it's pretty much a money thing. And all they want to do is just say, okay, as long as I can get my precious jewels and everything out of here at the best price, I'll support you if you give me more than what this regime is giving me or what these warlords are giving me. And I think that's bad because Africa has been at civil war for any country that I know the longest.
Sean, we got a bad line, but I think I've got the thrust of it. The U.S., you know, looking at profits and not humanitarian issues. On the other hand, there's been Darfur and the Sudan, where a lot of American interest has been expressed, and a lot of aid has gone. But let us hold that for a moment, if I may, Sean, and go to Congressman Adam Smith. He's a Democratic congressman, represents Washington State's 9th District. That's the South Puget Sound region. He's been calling for the United States to be more engaged in resolving the conflict in Congo. We've seen him out and about with Ben Affleck talking about this recently. Congressman Smith, thank you very much for being with us today.
Well, thanks for having me on, Tom. I appreciate it. Let me answer the question you asked a couple minutes ago. I think the U.S. definitely has strategic interests in the region. Certainly, it is a humanitarian crisis. By some estimates, as many as 3 million people have been killed in the region in the last 15 years. I've been there a couple times. You also have just, you know, huge internally displaced persons, refugee camps,
yep.
A massive rape problem, which is, you know, impossible to adequately describe. But the strategic interest we have is in the instability that it breeds in many countries. You mentioned Uganda and Rwanda, you know, South Sudan, Central African Republic border it as well.
Mm-hmm.
And the central problem here is that Kinshasa does not govern that part of the country. There is no adequate security forces there, so it becomes this lawless region where various, you know, bands of warlords and revolutionaries from everywhere are free to operate.
If its own government, then, Congressman, can't govern, what can we do? What could the United States do?
Here's what we have done. Two things that I think we ought to do. First of all, the U.S. has an excellent relationship with Uganda and Rwanda. We're very actively engaged in Uganda right now. Last time I was there, visited some of the places where we are training, actually, Ugandan military to go after the Lord's Resistance Army, mm-hmm. Joseph Kony, and also training the Ugandan military to help us in Somalia. We have a very tight relationship.
Yep.
We have a very tight relationship with Rwanda. We can send a high-level envoy to the region to broker an agreement. We have cachet, credibility in that region to bring those people together and work on it. But the more important thing long-term is security, and it's something we did about 2 or 3 years ago. AFRICOM, Department of Defense, trained a battalion of Congolese soldiers, and that battalion is very, very capable, but we stopped at one. Like, you know, 500 soldiers. If we were to help develop their security forces and have a presence there, That would certainly discourage Uganda and Rwanda from wanting to engage in a negative way, and it would begin to build up a meaningful security force that the people of the Congo can believe in. Because you're right. They don't want to be taken over by neighboring countries. They want their country to provide adequate security.
Well, let me challenge that picture just a little bit here. I mean, what could a high-level American envoy offer Rwanda that would be more valuable to them than enforcing peace as they see it on their border with Congo and all those resources inside Congo? I mean, what leverage do we have that compares to that?
The leverage is getting the world to pay attention. Okay, and this has happened. I mean, it happened to some degree in the South Sudan. A lot of these places where these horrific things go on, as long as no one's paying attention, the locals, neighboring countries feel like they can do whatever they want. But if the world is watching, if their credibility is on the line, Uganda, Rwanda, they have international interests as well. They don't want their reputations to be damaged by an ongoing humanitarian crisis that they have some responsibility for.
Okay, what about our credibility then? If I may, our U.N. Ambassador Susan Rice, who's so much in the news lately, this big U.N. report came out. It named Rwanda and Uganda as those backing M23, these rebels. And, I mean, I'm reading here that she had their names removed from the Security Council report to just talk about exterior actors. Talk about not putting players in a spotlight. Isn't that just the opposite?
Well, I think that's an exaggerated example. We have also cut off, I'm going to say, we have also cut off aid, some aid to Rwanda as, you know, response to this. And a lot of times what you need to do is privately pressure these countries to get them to start moving in a different direction. So, no, I don't disagree with you that the U.S. should be doing more. Let me be clear on that, and that our credibility in that sense is hurt. We have not done enough in the last 4 or 5 years. But the solution to that, I don't think, is to do less. I think the solution to that is to actually engage, get involved, and try to bring peace to the region.
Well, what do you say to those in the United States who are very grown fond of Rwanda, who see an orderly, kind of tidy regime that's emerged there and say, look, this is a better influence than the sort of, untrammeled warlord mess that we've seen in Congo? Rwanda's influence is a good one. Let them have some suzerainty here.
Two things. First of all, I don't necessarily disagree with that. I think Rwanda has to be part of this. Rwanda has a legitimate concern that there are rebel groups in eastern Congo that spill across the border and commit terrorist acts against Rwandans. So I think Rwanda needs to be part of the solution, needs to be brought in. But the second thing I would say is right now, they're not playing that positive role. When you look at what M23 is doing as they're rolling through those villages, they are doing the same raping, pillaging, terrorizing the population. So, yeah, Rwanda should be playing a positive role. We got to get in there and put pressure on them to do more of that.
Let's get a call from Nashville, Tennessee. Justin is calling. Hi, Justin. You are on the air.
Yeah. Hi, Tom. Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
I am from Nashville, as you said, and I work with the Great Lakes Action Network.
Great Lakes, as in the lakes there on the border of Rwanda and Kenya and beyond.
That is in the Congo, Rwanda, Burundi.
Congo, yeah. So yes?
Yeah. I want to make a comment on what your guests are saying. They are saying great things. So far, we haven't heard since the last 10 years. The world was not presented to the public, to the media, and so forth. But now, that's a good action. I'm thinking is good. But the point they are making that the world is complex, yeah, it may be complex. But the main actor is Paul Kagame, the president of Rwanda, and his army. So far today, the chief of M23, the chief leader, is the Minister of Defense in Kagame's government, James Kabarere.
So is Rwanda justified in having this?
They should stop Rwanda from invading Congo because Congo has been stable until Rwanda, and it is stable at least when Rwanda is not involved in that conflict.
Justin, I'm really glad for your call. Of course, this gets complicated in a hurry. I mean, Jennifer, as I listen to my caller, Justin, then I'm wondering, you know, what party of Rwandans is he from? Is he Tutsi along with Kagame or a Hutu who, you know, murderously opposed? I mean, but he's talking about very direct links to the interior circles of Kagame's government in Rwanda there, Jennifer. Does that sound right to you?
Well, it does from all the reports, I think, and I think that's right. Whether they have legitimate interests or self-serving interests or mercenary interests, you've got to be able to disengage Rwanda from this, militarily at least, before you begin to work on the political solution. Yes, the problem is in Kinshasa, and it is in Kigali. The first step towards that has to be to get the external military forces out of there so you can begin to deal on a political level with Kinshasa. As the congressman said, you're going to have to eventually include Rwanda's interests in this, make sure that they have a stake in whatever peace agreement is made and make sure that that serves their interest to a certain extent. But the first step has to be to pressure them to get out. We give them a lot of foreign assistance. European countries have been backing down on that. I think, you know, the glow is fading on Kagame, and I think they know that, and they've reacted very vehemently to reports of involvement, and they're extremely sensitive on this.
Let me get Jason Stearns. I just got him for another second here in Goma. Jason, what about it? What about the government of Joseph Kabila in Kinshasa, capital of Congo? I mean, the army chief of staff there, you know, suspended for selling crates of ammunition to elephant poachers. Maybe that's a hopeless government. Maybe M23 is right. Maybe it needs to go. What do you say?
Well, it's certainly true that the government in Kinshasa lacks vision, lacks leadership, is deeply corrupt. It is just coming out of a deeply fraudulent election last year that saw Joseph Kabila reelected as president. So I certainly have no quarrel with those who criticize the Congolese government. Rather, my quarrel is rather that the solution lies in a military rebellion. We've seen that movie before. This has been tried in 1996. It was tried in 1998.
Yep.
It was tried by the predecessor to the M23 and then finally the M23. So I don't think that the military rebellion is going to do anything except increase the suffering.
Jason Stearns in Goma, author of Dancing in the Glory of Monsters. Congressman Smith, first step for the United States, if you could take one today.
Send an envoy to the region. And the final point I want to say is this is an incredibly robust region. There's economic opportunity there, you know, in terms of our strategic interests, not just minerals.
And theirs.
Yeah, if they could get peace and stability, a lot of positive economic things could happen out of that region for us and for the world.
Congressman Adam Smith from Washington State's 9th District, thank you very much for being with us today, Congressman.
Thank you, Tom. Appreciate the chance.
Jennifer Cook, Director of the Africa Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, joining us today from Washington. Thank you so much, Jennifer.
Thanks, Tom.
And Jason Stearns, thank you very much for joining us from Goma, right there on Lake Kivu in eastern Congo. Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.